Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Today's guest, Seattle Times environmental reporter Linda Mapes, wanted to find a fresh way to tell the climate change story beyond politics or science. So she spent a year observing, studying, and enjoying a 100-year-old red oak tree inside the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts. In her new book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak, Linda Mapes takes us on her intimate journey. She writes about how one tree can tell the story of a complex ecosystem and how global warming is changing the timing of the seasons and our relationship with the natural world. You can see that in just one tree. She writes, quote, I found something else, too, which I didn't expect, a new way of thinking about how we might live together in the far future on a planet we've changed in ways we never meant to, end quote. So how should we rethink our relationship with trees and the natural world? Linda Mapes is an environmental reporter with the Seattle Times and author of several books. Her latest is Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. And she joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. It's such a beautiful book. And it's so, so important to remind everyone to get outside and get off their computer.
So true.
As an environmental reporter, you write that you really wanted to find kind of a fresh way and a new way to understand and tell the climate change story beyond politics or science. Tell us about that.
Well, I could just tell that people were tuning this story out. I mean, here it is, an existential scale crisis, and yet people were just getting sick of hearing about the parts per million or the dueling treaties or the dueling science. And you know, I could just tell that this story that's so important to the future of the planet, to all of us, was kind of going by the wayside. And I thought, how do we fix that as storytellers in the mainstream press, in newspapers? But, you know, what can I do about that as a reporter? And I decided that the thing to do was connect with what we all love, which is the living world, the charisma of nature. And I thought, here's what we can do. Get beyond the abstraction, get beyond the politics and the blah, blah, blah. Go to the real source of the truth, nature itself.
It's interesting you say that. What kind of reaction do you get from readers when you write stories about, say, parts per million or studies versus when you write stories about, like, the oceans or trees, for example?
Well, I'll tell you something. As a reporter who does write stories about studies and parts per million, I'm very strategic about this. When I need to write about something like that, I just did it last week, I always find a way to do it through an animal or a plant or a season, something people are viscerally, physically connected to, because that is the way to notice the particulars, to share the beauty and the wonder of this planet. That's what people care about. And then they can be interested in the parts per million or the study. And I have found that, number one, to be a lot more fun to do, much more rewarding. But it also connects with readers in a very real way. And I hear from people, email and phone, oh, thank you for telling me about what's going on with the orca whale, that they're starving. And the reason they're starving is they can't get enough Chinook salmon. That was a story I wrote last week. It was based on a study, and it also talked about parts per million of contaminants that are in the environment. And people read that story like crazy. And the reason they read it was because of this sad duo, this orca whale that depends on a threatened species, a Chinook salmon. It's really the only food that it will eat. And so you have an endangered animal depending on a threatened animal for its survival. That's a story that you want to know more about. What do we do about it? How did that happen? Tell me about the life history of this animal. Why does it only eat Chinook salmon? How stubborn? Well, it's because those whales are family units. They're clans. They have cultures, surely as we do. They matriarchal clans. The oldest female whale will teach the young what food is. And for this particular species, the southern resident species of orca whales, that's always only been one thing, Chinook.
Hmm. So to connect with your readers, you decided to spend a year with a tree. Why did you decide to specifically focus on a tree when you could have spent time with dolphins or orcas or any other animal or something like a tree, for example?
That's very true, because we do see the effects of climate change in so many ways in our world. But there were two reasons for this. Number one, I had the opportunity through a night journalism fellowship at MIT to look around, find experts, scientists who were working on this problem. And the person I found was actually at Harvard, and he had figured out that you could see seasonal shifts caused by climate change by watching the tree canopy. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You could see through when leaves first come out, when they color and drop, the tempo of the seasons, and you could see how over time that tempo, that seasonal clock, has really shifted because of our warming world. Well, so that took me to the forest, and specifically to the Harvard Forest, which has been around since 1907. It's 4,000 acres of a native New England wood, and that's where this professor and his lab were doing their work. So in a second year, I went out to the Harvard Forest as a Bullard Fellow in Forest Research, living at the Harvard Forest, literally living with my tree. Not in it. I had a house. But I spent an entire year watching one tree through its seasonal year with the help of a whole team of scientists, every ologist you could think of, biologist, ecologist, mycologist, probing the tree and its ecology and its history, by the way, the landscape history of its place. We'll talk more about that. And how you could see this global forest, usually thought of as somehow a far distant reality, climate change, you could really see how even within the leaf of one tree, there was already evidence of profound change.
Wow. You talked about the Harvard Forest, and you said that it was founded in 1907. And since then, scientists and students have explored the ways that biological, physical, and human systems interact to change the planet. What does it look like there?
Oh, it's such a delicious place. And I want listeners to know that this is a place that's open to the public 365 days a year, with trails that go all through these beautiful native New England woods. And you can ride a horse, you can take a walk, you can enjoy the quiet of this beautiful place and all of the animals in it. It's a classic New England wood. The species you would encounter there are oak and beech and white pine and hemlock, which is a whole different story, and we'll talk about the fate of hemlock too in the context of climate change. But you know what you'll also see there? And this was a major clue to me and my research, a whole system of stone walls. Now, those stone walls, they tell us that there's quite a history embedded in the landscape there. This is the agricultural history of New England. People working these tiny little hill farms, and the reasons those rocks are there is they're digging them out as they're farming their plots, creating pastures. Those are really rock dumps, those beautiful stone walls. And today, they wind all through the forest. And so what that tells us is a profound landscape shift because of a change in land use. It can't be overstated. Over the 6-state area of New England, the degree of change since people walked away from the farms. You know, people think about Thoreau writing, you know, like pen with a pencil off in the forest. That's not true at all. He was writing his beautiful works at the height of deforestation in New England. He used to say, "Thank God they can't cut down the clouds." He lamented the loss of the nobler animals, as he called them. This would be the moose or the deer or the bear. The biggest thing in the woods in his day was a muskrat. Well, today, the trees have come back because the people left to go work in the factories and the mills that are changing our world. And just in that 150 or so year time, those woods have come back, and with them, the animals. There's so many deer today, so many moose, so many bear. People in modern times are not even used to living this closely to that much wildlife. And so I see great hope in that you can actually cut down 6 states worth of woods and they will come back, and with them the animals. And you know what? In the spring, when those trees switch on, if you will, when they come into their leaves, you can actually see it at the global scale, a dip in the global level of CO2 in our atmosphere. So every tree counts, you know. It isn't only these glorious rainforests in the Amazon. These scrappy third-growth woods in New England, they count tremendously by way of habitat, mitigating the flow of water off the land, taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, providing homes for all of these animals, and yes, us.
You write about a process called coring, which gives us a lot of information about the age and the condition of a tree, and really tells the story of the tree's life. How is coring done?
This was really fun to discover. So the scientists who do this work, they're called dendrologists, and they're really the geologists of the biological sciences. They look into deep time. They look into the past. And they take a device that looks a little bit like a T. It has a long barrel and a T handle, which is turned, and they press it to the bark of a tree and just turn that handle and press in and press in, and it's driving a core into the tree. And it's a very tiny little core. It's called a microcore, and it's so small that you could fit a drinking straw inside of it. So this is a tiny core that is drawn from the tree. They could try to get all the way to the heart of the tree if the core is long enough. And you pull out that core, you bring it into the sunlight, and you see what is really a deep wand of time. You can see in that core, when you put it under a microscope, how the tree has grown year by year, because each year a tree makes a ring, and it really makes two rings. One is pale, and that's the summer wood. That's the beautiful first rush of growth in the spring, which is really a rebound from whatever resources it had the year before. Did it have a lot of sugar in its roots to bring up for that first flush of lovely new leaves that could really get it off to a fast-growing start? And then it lays down a second band. That's the later wood. And it is really the truth teller of that year. And you know, you look at those rings, and year by year, here's what you can tell. Was there an insect attack? A tiny little band. Was there a fire? A dark scar. Was there plenty of water? Great conditions. A big, fat band. And so you can really see what went on in the forest, too. Not only what the climatic conditions were and whether there were bugs or fire, but even what happened next door. If a tree that was crowding another tree falls over and suddenly this tree can surge into the sun, it releases, it lets go, it has a big burst of growth. And so you can also see the structure of the forest and how it changes over time. It's really a rather miraculous record, and it, without any doubt, it just absolutely tells the truth of what happened on that landscape. And you can corroborate what you see in the tree rings with other sorts of records, farmers' journals, newspapers, human history, to figure out what it was that happened that year. So these tree cores, they are a kind of history, a landscape history that every tree holds. Trees are our first journalists. They're our first scribes. And if you know how to listen to them, they're extremely eloquent storytellers.
I like that. How did you find your tree? You wrote that it was big, so big I couldn't see its top without dropping my head all the way back to my shoulders. It had no branches at all for the first 40 feet, then flared to a wide crown that dominated its grove. It was a wild tree. If I wanted to climb it, I'd need professional help. Ropes, helmet, harness, the works. But it was old, that much was clear. How did you find this one tree, considering you were surrounded by so many?
Exactly. I, at that point, was walking the woods with John O'Keefe, a biologist at the Harvard Forest, who had for 25 years been walking the same circuit of the same 50 trees. Why was he doing that? He was doing that to make very close observations of how the timing of the tree canopy had changed. And so I was walking this trail with John, and that's when I really got the idea for the book. And I thought, that's it. I need my own tree to be the main character in this story. So I wrote him an email one night, and I said, John, I need a tree. So we actually auditioned trees. We went on one of our weekly walks in the fall and looked at the trees one by one and thought about which might be the best subject to tell this story. And I had several favorites. There was a beautiful little striped maple that gets a lovely soft lemon yellow leaf in the fall. And it's got this snazzy striped photosynthesizing bark, but it was too small. I needed something grand and beautiful. So we walked on, and then we came to a beautiful tree. It's actually the oldest tree in the Harvard Forest. It's about 350 years old, but it was a black gum. And I thought, you know, people just aren't going to maybe identify with that. Not many people know what a black gum is. And so we walked on from that one, too. And then we came to a certain grove, and John put his hand on this beautiful big old red oak. And he said, "Here, I think this might be the one for you." And I looked at it, and I sized it up, and I thought, of course, oak. It's the most common tree in the Northern Hemisphere. If it were an animal, it would be a dog. And there's so much cultural resonance for people with oak, and everyone knows an oak tree that they love. So that was it. As soon as we confirmed that it was old enough by coring it, I needed at least 100 years, because that's when Model Ts first started coming off the assembly line and our carbon love affair really revved up. That, to me, made it the perfect tree. It was old enough, it was big enough, it was beautiful, and it was a common species. So that's how we picked that particular tree. Plus, it was in John's survey, so we had a lot of data about it. And furthermore, it was in the view of these cameras, these crazy cameras that Andrew, the professor at Harvard that started all this, had trained on the tree canopy in a tower 120 feet up. This was something completely new to science, this idea of using bank security cameras, of all things, to keep watch for leaves and upload digital images of the tree canopy every half hour in daylight hours and store those images so that you could analyze the information over time and recognize at scale how leaf on and leaf off had changed in its timing in the forest. This was what was so special about this duo of John's work and Andrew's. John was the up-close, on-the-ground, ground truth, literally, of what was happening in the forest. Andrew's work with the cameras gave you scale, literally, the forest and the trees. And so you put those together, and you had a very special look at just what was going on in this forest that could be then scaled up and looked at to understand how the biosphere is actually changing because of climate change.
It's amazing how cameras are being used now to learn more about the natural world. What did you learn about trees and the creatures that interact with them from this camera?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we also put a camera at my tree. We, in addition to the cameras that Andrew already had up, we put one right at the base of my tree. And you can look at it right now. You can go online and search Harvard Forest PhenoCams, pheno meaning, you know, phenology, study of the seasons, or just Harvard Forest webcams. And you'll see about six of them listed there at the Harvard Forest website. One of them is the Witness Tree Cam. That's my tree. I look at it all the time. You know, I just dial it up while I'm sitting in the newsroom in Seattle, and I see what's going on. Is it raining, snowing? Are the leaves on or off? It's like Facebook for nature. You can just check in with your friends. And we also put up a wildlife camera near my tree so that I could see who was in the neighborhood. And that was really special because it revealed the nighttime antics that are going on all around my tree. I would see, oh goodness, a beautiful fox with a long bushy tail walking down the stone wall, or maybe a big fat raccoon going out for a New Year's Eve party. It was great fun to realize all the life that was going on that I didn't see during the daytime. And in the spring, in the very early dawn, you'd see pairs of newborn deer coming along with their mom to just munch on the newly unfurling ferns. All of this on the wildlife camera. Every time I downloaded that chip, it was just a trip into an unseen world. And, you know, what Andrew is revealing in these images from the canopy is something else. I mean, he's looking at the timing of the seasons, and that itself has been a startling story.
Today, we're speaking with Linda Mapes about her new book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. Linda spent a year observing, studying, and enjoying a 100-year-old red oak tree inside the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts. And in her book, she takes us on her intimate journey. And Linda, I'm actually looking right now at the cam of your tree, and it's just beautiful. It's sort of this blue-gray sky. Just beautiful. I can tell just by the sound of your voice that you really miss your tree.
Oh, I do. I miss it terribly. I absolutely do. And I can feel it. As you talk about that, I know exactly how much of my spread arms reach around it. I know exactly what the bark smells like. I know precisely how it feels as I climb it. I can smell the acorns. It was a big acorn year this year, I hear. I can hear the birds around it. I spent so much time just being with that tree. And, you know, this is one of the things that came back to me working on this book was, you know, I actually grew up in a kingdom of trees. I was very lucky for that. My parents bought a place, a ramshackle old farmhouse built in 1762 with 7 acres of woods and a frog pond. You know, I grew up in a virtually feral existence. My mother would say, go outside and find something to do. And so we'd go out and swing on vines and dig holes and start fires. I don't know why any of us lived through it, but it was glorious. And, you know, that love of just being outside started early in me, and being at the Harvard Forest and being with my trees so much, it brought all that back. And you know, wherever it is that you grow up outside, you remember the smell of the soil, the slant of the light, the particular cadences of the insects unique to that place. And all of that was such a rich sense memory, and I took so much pleasure in being with that tree, you know, whether I was taking notes or taking pictures or taking a nap.
You mentioned acorns, and this is a great part of your book. You write about how trees germinate from an acorn left behind by a squirrel or maybe dropped by a bird or a chipmunk. It's just so, it's interesting to think about this, that these trees are probably planted far from home. And I just love how you write about this. Can you talk a little bit about the magic of the acorn?
You know, I was enchanted learning about this. I mean, every kid knows about acorns, right? It's one of the first things we draw in kindergarten. And we all know that mighty oaks from an acorn come. And it's always seemed miraculous to me. You have this little tiny thing. It doesn't even fill your palm. And from it, this gigantic tree that will persist for hundreds of years grows. Well, how does that happen? Well, inside of each one of those acorns is packed. Everything that's needed to grow that giant tree is within that little tiny package genetically and also nutritionally. These are very rich nuts. They're full of protein. They've got just the right amount of fat. And so everything in the woods craves acorns. You have hundreds of species that rely on acorns in the woods. Everything from deer to wild turkeys to chipmunks to squirrels to blue jays, even bears eat acorns. And, you know, it's so interesting how the trees manage the fact that so many animals eat their acorns, because obviously if they ate them all, we wouldn't get any more oak trees. But they have a very ingenious way of dealing with this. They have what's called a mast year, M-A-S-T, which is when they put out an unusually large number of acorns, easily a third more than the existing troops of animals can eat. And so what happens is the animals, first of all, have a fiesta in the forest. I mean, they just absolutely pig out. But there's still even more acorns left over for the next generation. But even so, there's another step that has to happen. And this is where this beautiful interdependence between the tree and the animals comes in, because acorns have to have some sunlight to sprout. They won't sprout right underneath the mother tree. They've got to be transported. Well, so how does that get done? Enter the chipmunk, enter the squirrel, enter the blue jay, and they each have a different role to play. The blue jays are the long-distance dispersers. They'll take an acorn as far as a mile from that tree. Very essential for genetic diversity and the possibility of a nice sunny spot. And they'll fill up their pouch and they'll fly, you know, long distance, and they will disperse the acorns. But then you have this incredible dance going on with the squirrels. And if you sit underneath an oak tree, you begin to realize in fall that you're actually in a very busy place. You have chipmunks coming and going. You have squirrels coming and going. And they are gathering these things, and they're taking them, and they're burying them. And they are making caches of these acorns. And it is a forgotten acorn that gives us the forests of the future. And I think to myself, how admirable it is that they don't forget more. I mean, we're talking in the course of a season about thousands of acorns. And there was a scientist I talked to who was really interested in this relationship between squirrels and oak trees and acorns. And he really got into it. And he learned a couple things that I never would have guessed. And one of them is that the squirrel will actually test each acorn before it will bother to pick it up. He'll give it a fast little head shake, so fast that the only way he could see it was to slow down the camera, the film. And what he discovered the squirrel was doing was checking the quality of the acorn. And if it heard any rattle, that meant a weevil had gotten to it and already chewed the nut inside a little bit. And so he would just drop it, walk away, wouldn't bother with that acorn. I mean, how smart is that? And then the other thing he did was he actually live trapped these squirrels, and he would confine them, feed them, take care of them for a couple of weeks, as long as 3 weeks. You know what he was testing? He wanted to know if they would remember where they'd put their acorns if he took them away from their environment for a couple of weeks. And so he would trap them, he would hold them for 3 weeks, and then he would release them. And you know what? Boom, right to the acorns. They knew exactly where they had put them. And wow. I always think to myself, remember that the next time you walk into a room and you can't remember why you went there.
Exactly. And we think we're so smart humans, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Today we're speaking with Linda Mapes, an environmental reporter with the Seattle Times, about her new book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. Linda spent a year observing and studying a 100-year-old red oak tree inside the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with Linda Mapes, an environmental reporter with the Seattle Times. She's out with a new book called Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. Linda spent a year enjoying, studying, and observing a 100-year-old red oak tree inside the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts. As a reporter who writes about climate change and lots of studies and facts, she wanted to find a fresh way to tell the story beyond politics or science. So she spent a year with a tree. And as you can tell from her voice, she misses her tree and she loves her tree. Linda, before the break, you were telling us great stories about squirrels and critters and their relationship with the acorns. And is there anything else? I mean, did you know much about this before you started this journey?
You know, I didn't. I just knew about it superficially. I'd spent a lot of time in the woods as a kid, but I didn't know how interwound the lives of the animals and the oak tree really were. I mean, for instance, in a year that you have a lot of acorns, that will ripple all the way through different animals in the forest. Deer, because they get so many more acorns to eat, they'll have more twins. Not only that, but because you have more deer running around, you'll get more deer ticks. Not a great thing, because that actually is a way that people can get Lyme disease. So we really are all connected. People say that sort of casually, but you know, it is very true.
Wow. And you write that even the acorn is amazing. It takes 2 years to grow and ripen, forming from the female flower in early spring, falling to the ground from August to October, and chilling over the winter. What else did you learn about acorns?
Well, here's the other thing. An oak tree won't even make acorns for 50 years.
Wow.
And so this is one of the reasons mature trees, big trees, really matter. You know, this idea that you can just have a bunch of little street trees and it's all good. I mean, with an oak tree, you got to get some size and some age on these things before you get acorn production. And the other thing that I did with acorns was sprout them. I thought that was a lot of fun. I would, in the early spring, look around for these acorns that had started to swell and split, and you could see actually the kind of pink color of the meat of the acorn starting to show in the crack in the shell, and even a little bit of a taproot starting to emerge at the end. Well, I would gather those and I'd pot them up. It was so fun to watch them start to make these little beautiful, perfect oak trees. And, you know, then you can see the leaves up close because usually they're way high above your head. But in this case, I could watch them emerge. Did you know that little baby oak leaves are actually completely covered with fur? They almost look like a little mouse. They have so much fuzz. And the reason for that, and they're pink, by the way, they don't start out green. And the reason for that is there's a lot of colorant in the leaf to act as a kind of sunscreen. And all that fuzz, that's a windbreak to protect the leaf from drying out too much. And leaves themselves are fascinating. You know, they take a long time to mature to that full size with a waxy cuticle on top. It takes at least a month, 6 weeks, which is why in the spring, the leaves have that soft, fluttery texture to them, and that brighter green that you only see in the early spring, that all changes by the solstice in June. By then, they're revved up, ready to go, full size, but not all the same size. This is the other thing I learned about leaves. You know, you look at just one tree, my tree, and it's covered with oak tree leaves, of course, but they're all different sizes. If you pick up a leaf that was on the lower branches of the tree, this is called a shade leaf. And it is so much bigger and so much broader than the leaves at the very top. These are called sun leaves, and they have a completely different shape. They're more deeply scalloped, and they're much smaller. Well, think about that. Why would that be? It's because there's so much heat up there. There's so much sun that really it could be damaging to the leaves. You're getting so much sunlight. You're virtually at the limit of what proteins can deal with in a leaf. And so it's a different shape to help it shed heat. Whereas those shade leaves, they're trying to get every scrap of light they can possibly get. Heat isn't at all the same issue. So they have these big, broad, flat, luxuriant shapes. And I found that just fascinating that a tree is that well adapted to its place, and not only within the forest, but the leaves themselves in their place on the tree. And then they've got all these great adaptations to deal with wind and forces of drag. I mean, if you look at a single tree, these are masterful engineers. They can pump water 300 feet in the air without making a single sound. I mean, if you or I were to do that, we need all kinds of equipment and pumps and racket and noise. And, you know, these trees can take care of their needs in the same spot without moving for hundreds of years. And not only do they not just spoil it and strip it of its resources, they actually make it better. And they sustain not only themselves, but entire communities of lives all around them.
Speaking of water, I also learned a lot about the relationship between trees and water in your book. Again, this is amazing to think about. When you went out with John O'Keefe, it was the week before Thanksgiving 2013, and you write that frost was already in the ground and the sun streamed through mostly bare branches. And he said, "I'm going to say that is running hard." As you crossed the bridge over a brook at the beginning of the walk, the water was flowing faster now than just the week before because the trees had begun to go dormant for the season. And what we were seeing, you write, was an indicator that the symphony of the forest was transitioning to the slow movement of winter, the trees taking up less water and leaving more in the stream. You write, "This was new to me, what a window the streams, puddles, and vernal pools were into the lives of trees. It had never occurred to me how intimately they are connected."
Exactly. I just loved learning that. I mean, the way that the terrestrial world is absolutely connected by trees to the atmospheric world. It makes total sense when you stop and think about it, but I never had. And so when John O'Keefe was walking in the fall and explaining that to me, I thought, of course, the vernal pools, the streams, this is the surface water that we see and hear all around us. Of course, it would be absolutely connected to what the trees are up to. And when they're not pulling up water for their photosynthetic process and emitting it to the air, of course there would be more water in the streams, more water in the vernal pools. And this is why John's method of looking at the forest understory, walking the forest and looking closely, was a perfect way to see what the ecological tempo of the forest was. Were we in spring, summer, fall, winter? There were so many different shades of change in the forest that are cast by the trees. And I think that you know, understanding something is a way to also more deeply appreciate its beauty. And that certainly happened for me when you can see these interstitial connections between the trees and all the different aspects of the wood and how it functions. John revealed that to me in each one of these walks, and what a great joy that was. And you know, it's also interesting to think about how this changes over time, because again, going back to the time when New England was deforested, these streams had a lot more water in them. And that's one of the reasons that they could be used to turn mills, because the current was bigger, faster, heavier. The trees had been cut. Today, you look at some of those streams and you think, huh, how did anybody ever have a mill on that thing? Mm. Well, the difference is the trees are using that water now. And this is one of the reasons, too, that in the summer you have that incredible humidity, and it can be kind of, you know, the very air itself feels thick. Well, that's because it is. The trees are exuding these tiny, 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 tiny mists of water, so tiny you can't even see it. But they're pumping gallons and gallons and gallons of water into the air through tiny little pores on the undersides of their leaves.
What are your thoughts about deforestation as you're talking about forests? I mean, we've seen climate change, logging, mining, you know, other industries destroy millions of trees from California to the Amazon. And I mean, it's just so sad when you read about and you see videos of what's going on in the Amazon. When you talk to experts about this issue, what do they tell you about repopulating the forests?
Well, there are things to know about this that are actually very heartening. And one of them is that trees and forest ecosystems are amazingly resilient. I mean, if you lay off and let them recover, very often they will do that. It doesn't always happen. It depends on what the disturbance or the destruction has been. I mean, there are places that are now burning so hot and so hard that they're actually not expect, and so frequently, that's an important factor, they're actually not going to reset to forest. They're going to reset to grass, which is kind of a startling idea. You know, forest ecosystems are under human pressure all over the globe, and it's for a number of reasons. You know, it has to do with the insects that are being transmitted by our global trade. So we have this unwitting transfer of insects here, there, everywhere. And then because winters are warmer than they used to be, these insects can expand their range. You don't have the killing cold that used to keep these populations in check. You have a whole change in the hydrologic cycle in places because of climate change. Once again, you've got snow melt coming earlier and less precipitation coming as snow. And so places that used to have much more moisture in the soil and snowpack, those are places that are starting to dry up a lot earlier in the year. They're much more prone to fire than they used to be. And so all of these things are taking their toll on trees, in addition to just plain old intentional clearing and replacement of forest ecosystems with agriculture or development. And I guess the thing to say about that is, number one, we've seen in New England that you can have a gigantic rewilding, recovery of even very large areas if they're just given the chance. And so in that, we should take great hope. And I would also say that trees are a remarkably simple solution to our climate problem. I mean, here you have a natural system that does everything we need done. Cooling, absorbing of carbon dioxide, slowing and tempering runoff, creating habitat for animals, and even cooling refugia for people. You know, you go into a forest, and what is one of the first things you say? Ah, because it's cool and it's beautiful and it's refreshing. So these trees that that we beloved, we need to also respect. They are a very important piece of already dampening the effects of climate change. There should be almost 20% more CO2 in the atmosphere today because of the amount that we are emitting from our cars and our factories and burning coal. Well, where is it? Why don't we see it? Well, it's because it's been taken up in the ocean, for one, but also in the trees. And so they're doing us this big favor of very much tempering the results of climate change. But, you know, they can't keep up with the rate by which we are emitting CO2. And so we need to do our part too. That is absolutely critical. We're at more than 400 parts per million now today, CO2. My tree, when it sprouted, it was more like 300. And we can already see changes in my tree because of the shift in the composition of the atmosphere. Not only the temperature, but the composition of the atmosphere.
Since 1978, over 289,000 square miles of rainforest have been destroyed across Brazil, Colombia, Bolivia, Peru. It's a long list. What happens when these rainforests are destroyed?
Well, I mean, these are actually fragile soils, weirdly, right? I mean, you would think that those are places with these deep, deep, robust soils. It's actually not true. And so when you take out a rainforest, that's a very scarring, damaging event. And it happens not only at the level of the soil, but in the level of the atmosphere. I mean, these are places that cleanse the air to a spectacular degree. They create their own climate, for heaven's sakes. And so alteration of that particular system, that's very serious. And it's a loss that we really shouldn't allow to happen. And so this is where you begin to ask the question, well, what do you do about that? I mean, how do you make it fair for the people who are there? And, you know, they can't be asked to shoulder the entire cost of preservation that the whole planet needs. And these are some of the political solutions that have got to get figured out. But there's just no question that trees, if you were to pick a one-word answer to our predicament on this planet, trees is certainly one of the words you would say. And the trees in the rainforest are among the most valuable that we have to keep. These are entire ecological systems, worlds that just can't be destroyed. And I think that, you know, people know this, but they need to know it more urgently. I mean, for instance, let's go back to my tree and just ask ourselves, well, okay, what's happening even in just one tree that can help us understand how linked our activities really are to the ecosystems around us? Well, in my tree, we can see from studies at the Harvard Forest, we know, because they have the longest record there anywhere of atmospheric exchange of the forest. Red oak is the dominant tree at the Harvard Forest. And so we look over the past 25 years and we see that red oak is actually growing faster than ever. It's actually absorbing more carbon than ever. It's bench pressing carbon like a CrossFitter. And that was a surprise to people. They thought maybe a tree as old as mine, 100 years old, you wouldn't see that, but you do see it. And so we know they're growing faster. That's one point. But there's something else. We also know that they're doing that more efficiently. Andrew Richardson, the professor with whom I worked at Harvard, learned with the collaborators in his lab that actually these trees are using less water, even as they grow faster. Now, why is that? It's because on the undersides of the leaves, those stomata, those little tiny openings that I talked about that the water comes out of, those are like mouths. Those are the openings by which trees actually breathe. They take in the CO2 in our atmosphere that is their carbon source, their sugar, by which they make food, and they breathe out the oxygen that we need as well as water. Well, so let's think about this. There's way more carbon in the atmosphere now because CO2 levels are so high. And so the trees, my tree in particular, can get all the food that it needs, all the nourishment that it needs by opening its stomata less. Why would it want to do that? Because that way it loses less water. And that's exactly what we see. The tree is growing faster, it's getting all the food it needs to grow fast, and it's using less water to do it. And Andrew's lab found out something else that was really interesting to me, even a little disturbing, which is that the seasons are now so supersized, the growing seasons are so long, they're actually lasting longer than the leaves, that the weather can still be fine, the temperature's warm, even late into fall, and yet the tree has already senesced. It's dropped its leaves. Well, why is that? You'd think it would go as long as it possibly could. Well, that's because the timing of its ancient ancestors, its DNA, are still baked into that tree. You know, it hasn't shifted as much as the temperature has shifted, as much as the seasonal calendar has shifted. And so we really see two seasons now. They're the seasons in living things, and they're the seasons made by us.
Today, we're speaking with Linda Mapes, environmental reporter with the Seattle Times, about her new book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. She spent a year with a 100-year-old red oak tree inside the Harvard Forest in central Massachusetts, and she takes us on her journey in this book. Linda, tell us a little bit about the history of the red oak tree.
Ah, the red oak. You know, we have quite a connection with this species. Oak trees in general, red oak, white oak. It's interesting to me just how wedded we are to this tree. You know, the whole history of the British Royal Navy going all over the world, waging war and colonial this and that and the other. Well, you know, the reason they were able to do that was because of their oak forests, these hearts of oak, they call them. You know, they made those ships out of oak timbers because they were what was strong enough. And even a particular part of the oak where the branch joins the trunk, that's called a knee. And it's uniquely strong, and that particular piece of the oak was used to join certain parts of the ship's architecture. And you know, it's interesting, too, that the mast trees, the masts that were on these ships, came from our shores. You know, the crown actually regarded itself as owning these very, very large white pine that were in the colonial woods, and they would actually mark them with what was called the King's Broad Arrow with an axe. And the colonists would get in big trouble if they cut any of those trees. And this actually was one contributing factor in the beginning of our Revolutionary War. If you know your Revolutionary War flags, you know that one of them had a pine tree on it. And it was because the colonists wanted those pine trees for themselves, their own commerce, their own building materials. They didn't want the king to be taking them for masts for their ships. And so this connection between the oak trees and also the pine forests, the trees themselves, and human history is very plain to see. And in the United States, you know, the oak has always been a very important tree culturally and practically. You know, in New England, when it was time to pay the taxes or send somebody to college, oak trees were called the tuition tree. That's where you went for some fast cash. And after we lost chestnuts, sadly, that magnificent tree, oak trees became the construction material of choice. And so oak trees, you know, they go deep and they go far into human culture. Even the use, by the way, of acorns, well, it was always understood that that was great food for livestock. Acorns were terrific for pigs, and farmers counted on being able to fatten their animals by running them in the forests.
You climbed 60 feet into the tree's crown with ropes and harnesses. You say that really changed your relationship with the tree. What was it like to be up there?
That was really glorious. You know, I just became very sure early on in this project that as a writer, I needed to not only look at my tree from down on the ground, you know, remotely, I needed to feel it. I needed to get up in it. And I thought, well, how am I going to do it? You know, this isn't like climbing some of those trees that I climbed as a kid. This thing didn't even have any branches until way up there. And so I hired Melissa and Bear Lavangi. These are twin sisters who live in Petersham, Massachusetts. They're both champion tree climbers, and Melissa is actually the tree warden for the town of Petersham. Now, this is a great thing. A tree warden is the person in every town in Massachusetts charged with taking care of the shade trees in the public realm. Doesn't that sound like a good idea? I think we need tree wardens everywhere. It's like the Lorax, you know. But the two of them are incredible tree climbers, strong, graceful, confident, joyful, and I hired them to teach me how to climb a tree. And I thought, you know, my initial thought was, oh, we'll just go up once, I'll take a few notes, and that'll be that, I'll come down. Well, that is not what happened. Because predictably, the first time that they got me up there, I loved it, you know, to feel the tree actually bear my weight, to feel the spring of its branches, to feel it move in the wind. You know, they don't just go back and forth. They go up and down. That was something I never understood before. And so, sure enough, I mean, the first time we went up, I was scared to death, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But we got up there safely, of course. That was their number one concern. And then once I was up there, to be able to see the canopy from within, to understand the structure of it, to see how the branches of my tree reach just to the tips of the branches of the tree next door, not quite touching. Scientists actually have a name for that, which I find very lovely. It's called canopy shyness. And we started climbing really as often as the weather and their schedule could tolerate it. You know, we finally got to go up with leaves on the tree because I started in the late fall, and then we climbed in the winter with snow on the branches. That was quite beautiful. And the tree felt like iron underfoot, you know, because it was just, it was wintertime. But then we went up in early June, and that was transformational for me. You know, it was the first time I'd been in the tree with it covered with leaves, and it was, if it was in this fine, just resplendent green robe. And we climbed all the way up to the top that day, and there was a special surprise for me. Melissa and Bear had put a hammock up there. And I had brought a picnic, you know, this fantastic picnic. This was not granola bars. No, it was a real feast. We roasted a chicken, and I had dark chocolate, and we had some just delicious incendiary dal. And the three of us sat up there, I don't even know for how long, and we, you know, eating our feast and just quietly enjoying being in the tree. And, you know, to be in the canopy from within, that's a different experience. You know, the tree just flows back and forth in the wind, and the branches part and the light comes down on you, the sunlight, and the shadow is not like the shadow of the forest floor. It's much lighter, it's lacy, and it's ever moving. And the birds called to us, and butterfly went right by my shoulder, and you know, there was a whole different ecosystem up there. I could see all these different lichen and moss and all the insects on their urgent errands. And, you know, the hammock would just rock with the motion of the tree. And it was very amniotic and primal. And I thought to myself, you know, trees are these very different special beings. They're completely wild. We need them. They don't need us, actually. And I thought to myself while I was up there that, you know, we would do so well to mimic the genius of trees, how they live with all these other species in a perfect diplomatic relationship that endures over time and is nourishing, you know, at every level between the mycorrhizal fungi and their roots and all the communication that goes on in the soil with other trees, even other species. And of course, that beautiful interconnection with all the animals that we talked about, and they're incredibly clever at self-defense. If they start to get munched too heavily by caterpillars, trees can actually change the chemistry of their leaves so they're less palatable. They can even, through pheromones, call in a whole predatory airstrike of wasps to defend themselves. You know, how sophisticated they are, how well they live with other species, how they can be in one place and not only not deplete it, but actually make it better. You know, I thought to myself, we need a tree culture. We need this kind of nourishing collective enterprise that a forest is. We should be inspired by trees. We should take them as mentors and try to live as intelligently as they do.
Linda Mapes is an environmental reporter with the Seattle Times. Her new book is called Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. Linda, it's a beautiful book. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for giving a voice to the trees.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco, and you can find more information about today's show and all of our One Planet series at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.